Mini-episode 114 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 114 of the FDH Lounge and part three of our FantasyDraftHelp.com insider preview of the 2012 NFL Draft. We have with us today my partner, Jason Jones, our senior editor, who is in charge of all coverage for the NFL and NBA draft for FantasyDraftHelp.com and the FDH Lounge. It is his scouting. It is his evaluation work that powers us on both sides. And as I say, today we're talking NFL draft. This is part three. We have been serializing our brand new thing that you can get at FantasyDraftHelp.com. And the FDHLounge.com, our brand new draft guide, Pro Football Draftology 2012. And it is, again, Jason's work, that his evaluation, his scouting that has been powering this guide. It is his rankings in there. It is his features, the things that he's come up with that are the foundation for our guide. We have some other things that are contributed in there as well. We have an NFL draft play-along game. If you're having a first-round draft party with your friends, you can check that out. We have any number of other features, but there are always features that Jason adds to the guide every year based on his scouting and his evaluation. So what we're going to be doing today is taking an overview of the draft. We'll be tying some things back to Pro Football Draftology 2012, some of the features that Jason has come up with, some of his thoughts along the way, and essentially just how our chief of NFL scouting views this year's event and how he has shaped his coverage accordingly. So we'll be taking that overview with him and bring him on right now. My good friend, our senior editor, Jason Jones, bring him on the program. Jason, welcome to the show, buddy. How you doing?
All right. new baby stuff to deal with, but, you know, otherwise pretty good.
Yes. I don't know if we've addressed that previously on the program. Congratulations. I think this is your first time on since that hit. So good to have you on with us here today. And in the final goings over of this, we were putting this together, there were any number of things that came to mind. And I have questions about one or two players specifically on whether or not they're first-round values. But I think what I'd like to do is just to start with this. When I was talking about some of the features you came up with, how you evaluated some of the guys this year for the guide. One of the things specifically that you did, and my guess is that this is going to be a valuable thing to tell people as far as how you were framing your view of this draft and how it compared to last year. For as much as you and I are fans of mashups in music, and we've done segments mm-hmm. on the FDH Lounge previously about that, you did essentially a mashup of the 2011 and 2012 draft classes. That is one of the primary features in our draft guide here. So let's take a minute and start about that and how you came to view this year's class and the depth that it has versus last year.
Well, first gut reaction just in concept is that this year's draft is deep, whereas last year's draft is not, if I want to be absolutely blunt about it. And the nice thing about that is, as you look through this feature, you'll see there are chunks of guys. And I'll just bring up wide receiver just to start. You look at it and you see, in my opinion, I think Justin Blackmon is the best receiver of the last two drafts. I think he's not the biggest guy, he's not the fastest guy, but his catching radius is remarkable. But then you've got A.J. Green, who went first off the board among wide receivers, and then Julio Jones, who went shortly thereafter. And after that, you've got six guys in a row from this year's draft class. And that's just one example of how this breaks out. Defensive tackle is another one. it's just, it's not even close to me in certain positions where this year it's, you can go ahead and not take the first guy on your board at that position and come back around to a round and a half later and really not lose that much value at all.
Yeah, this year's draft has been a very, very good. One of the features that I ended up doing for the draft was the ranking of strength by position. And we had, in the end, 10 of the 14 that ended up rated good or better. And so it's almost the exception to the rule this year, the positions that are not as strong. But when you're looking at this, and again, another feature that we ended up doing in the guide here, we have a top 50 overall, which we are wont to do with our NFL and NBA drafts. But you took it a step further to perceived value and actual value. And of course, that is what exists every year. We don't always hear it broken out that way, but we just sort of hear the perceived value, the conventional wisdom value taken as the actual top rankings that anybody puts out there. But indeed, there is also a secondary thing, and I'm very glad you chose to underline that this year, that if you strip away the politics, if you strip away the perceptions, if you strip away all of the you can't take this guy in this spot, you'd end up with a different set of rankings, and it's great that people will be able to compare and contrast between the two.
Yeah, you know, I think this is something that most of us would consider a pet peeve. It's that you watch on television, you listen on sports talk radio, and you hear these people that say, you know, so-and-so has got to go here. And you think to yourself, no, he doesn't. And I think the most important example, and you're going to hear his name come off the board on the first few picks, is Matt Khalil. And this happens almost every year in almost every professional draft. Matt Khalil may be the best offensive tackle in this draft, but Matt Khalil would not even sniff the likes of a Joe Thomas, a Jake Long, and so on. So the nice thing here is as people are looking at the draft and seeing who's coming off the board, and when they see a guy come off for their team, it's just another feature that allows them to check out the draft guide and really get a more in-depth look at the player that they've got.
And it's interesting because in going down the mock drafts, of course, you and I both, I think, fell in line with the conventional wisdom on this. A lot of times when there's smoke, there truly is fire. In terms of Minnesota taking him with the third pick in the draft, that was something that you and I both thought would be the case. We start to diverge a little bit after that. One of the most interesting spots in the draft, of course, with Luck going one, RG3, two, to Washington, who traded up, and then Khalil, three. What are the Browns going to do at four? I dare say, as a lifelong Browns fan, what you picked is what I'd like to see. Justin Blackmon, wide receiver from Oklahoma State, the aforementioned wide receiving ace in this class, which I'm going out on a big limb here, but I personally have branded the best wide receiving class since the legendary class of 96. I'd like to see that. I, however, on the fourth pick, I'm falling in line with what appears to be the developing conventional wisdom. Trent Richardson, running back, Alabama. At four there, a superstar back, the best in the class, and by a decent margin, maybe even a bigger margin, at least in terms of perception, than Blackmon is number one at his position. But that right there really kind of sets the key for what happens in a lot of the draft after that and the way that things could break, because there's even talk still about will the Browns reach for Ryan Tannehill with the fourth pick? Will they perhaps go Morris Claiborne and throw a monkey wrench into this and throw out drafting for offensive need, which is dire, throwing that out the window altogether. So four really looks like the linchpin here for where things could start to go any number of different ways.
Yes, but I would like to sort of preface that by saying I don't think it matters if it's Richardson or Blackmon, because I think once you get to pick seven, it corrects itself no matter what.
Yes.
Because
you and I were different on 4, 5, 6, Jason. You and I were different on 4, 5, 6, and then you get to 7, and you and I start making some of the same picks again. So you're right about that.
Yeah. Now, as far as the thought process for Cleveland, it is the first pick that you kind of say this could dictate the rest of the draft. And the reason I went with Blackmon is because quite frankly, I don't think the ideal is going to be there, even if Cleveland thinks it will be. Make no mistake about it, Trent Richardson is a beast. And the way I've described it to people in the last month or so is, he reminds me a lot of Maurice Jones-Drew if Maurice Jones-Drew had prototypical size, or maybe even bigger than prototypical size. So you take the reigning rushing leader with the ability to catch the ball, pass block, do all the things you want him to do. He's a no-brainer at the position, and if they take him, I think Browns fans should be happy with that. My concern, more importantly for them, is back up off the Colt McCoy talk and start building that offense up around in other positions. And to do so, I think they need to get at least three starters on offense out of this draft. My reasoning for going Blackman first is I think that you can still get a very, very good running back. I'm lobbying for the second running back off the board to go to Cleveland at 22. But either way, I think they get a phenomenal player. They're either going to get the best running back on the board, or they're going to get the best wide receiver on the board. And either way is good enough for me. Regardless of what happens, I think I would be content. Now, if they go and take Tannehill, I may book a flight to Cleveland so I can go burn the building down. I seriously believe Tannehill is, forget the off-the-field stuff, just on the field as far as what his rookie season looked like. I think he's the Ryan Leaf of this draft class. I really do. I think the guy is absolutely putrid. And if they go with Morris Claiborne, then you've reached on two shutdown corners in the top 10 in a couple years, and that I also have a problem with. If you're the Cleveland Browns, I can't imagine what's going through your mind if you don't have this narrowed down to Blackman or Richardson by now.
I think they probably do. Just to looking at it, and this is, as I'm talking to you, this is a true hot off the presses deal here, as the guide is literally being finished and being posted just about in real time as you and I are speaking. So you've not seen my final mock draft yet, which was just about the last feature to go into this thing. I've actually got Kendall Wright going to the Browns at 22, and I hope this doesn't make you want to slash your wrists, Jason. I've got your boy Doug Martin going to New England at 27.
Oh, that hurts.
I thought it might.
I think all the people in New England are not going to like this. But I really think there should instate some new draft rule that as long as Belichick's the coach and Tom Brady is the quarterback, it should be some sort of violation for them to get something like that. Same thing with Pittsburgh. They shouldn't be able to accidentally get the best player on the board without moving up to get him. Love Doug Martin. My concern for Cleveland would be, Kendall Wright's nice, but I'm afraid that he benefits from being wide open. It's one of those things that you look at him on tape and he's phenomenal. There was a game early in the season, I forget or I have something in my head who it was against, but the guy had like five touchdowns. Wright, not Griffin. And he looked great, but man, is he open. And in the NFL, those safeties and corners converge a lot faster than they do in college. So that would concern me a little. But the bigger picture here is they can get Trent Richardson at 4 and come back at 22 if they're smart enough and get a wide receiver who is still very good. And I would say you could go as far down the board as Alshon Jeffrey, who out of South Carolina, who I think is he's not a lock to be great, but I think he's got the physical ability to be very, very good. And there's a lot of people out there that believe that the way the board is shaping up, if Michael Floyd isn't off the board in the first 10 picks, there's a very serious possibility he could be there at 22. So, again, any permutation here works for Cleveland. They are one of the, say, top three teams that I find most intriguing in the first round or two.
I agree. I certainly think that is the case. A couple other things I'd like to ask you about with the first round before we kind of broaden this out a bit. One being, and I had a conversation yesterday with another one of our FDH draft contributors, Chris Galloway, one of our original FDH Lounge dignitaries, who I understand will be joining us when we do our post-draft wrap-up next weekend. So his thought on this, there's a player that he was touting to me very strongly, and he said, I know that this can sound like a surface kind of comparison because they're both Yellow Jackets, but Stephen Hill said he sees a little bit of Megatron in him, loves the upside, and he said he thinks in a couple of years could be possibly regarded as the best wide receiver in the end.
You know, the funny thing is, as you're saying all that, I'm trying to figure out where you're going with this. Stephen Hill is, if you again, take the politics out, take, you know, Luck and Griffin out of the mix, Trent Richardson, Blackman, you take the guys that are givens out of it, Stephen Hill may be my favorite player in the first round.
Okay.
Stephen Hill, I'll be honest, coming into the combine, I knew who he was. Not a whole lot of intrigue about it because, let's be honest, for the last few years, if you come from Georgia Tech, everyone's going to go, yeah, but it's an option offense. I think he has the potential to be special. He's got legitimate 4.3 speed. I forget exactly what the numbers were, but it was like in the combine, he ran like 4.3 flat, and they thought, okay, something's wrong here. That's our unofficial time. Second time around, ran 4.31. He is legitimately that fast. And unlike Demaryius Thomas, who came out of Georgia Tech recently, he is also a solid, I want to say 220 to 225. He's closer to Megatron in that he's pushing 6'4 and a half, I believe. So, yeah, if any wide receiver to come out of that region is any even in the stratosphere of Calvin Johnson, it's Stephen Hill. The problem is people are still hesitant because, you know, his stats don't measure up because they don't throw to him as much. But when they throw to him, he makes it happen. I absolutely love him there, and I'll say one of the other teams I'm very intrigued by is Denver, and I definitely want to see Peyton Manning get somebody like a Stephen Hill because, you know, you get a guy like Peyton Manning, you got to give him some toys. But, no, I absolutely love that player. Alongside that, you still have you mentioned Kendall Wright. There's a couple wide receivers that are sort of on the fringe there. But, again, it's deep in the class, and I do like any of those guys that will be available after 20, unless somebody reaches on the kid from Rutgers, whose name escapes me at the moment. But that goes back to value, and we're big sticklers for value. So
that's important. Sanu, that everybody, you're talking about.
Yeah,
you're talking about Sanu.
I think he's good. I think he's very good. I just think, you know, he's a second rounder.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm not seeing him go in the first round in too many drafts. Well, this is really something people can look forward on our post-draft coverage to a thorough, comprehensive Stephen Hill love fest when we get you guys together and compare your various opinions of him. Yeah, I'm glad we're getting to talk wide receivers as much as we are because, again, to me, that's kind of – if you want to boil it down, I'd say to one story of this class, I'd say it would be that, you know, even though Luck and Griffin are obviously getting – the love at the top there. But, again, you always have a marquee quarterback or two at the top of a draft. It's what else separates a draft. As I'm looking at this here and as I was going through on the final mock drafts that you and I prepared, there are two guys that jumped out at me, and I'm very, very interested to get your opinion because they're guys where you are a little bit of an outlier as far as how you have them slotted here. And I know everybody who knows FDH knows that you have reasons for everything that you do. So your thoughts on two guys who most draft analysts out there have going in the latter part of the first round, Whitney Mercilus of Illinois, who I have going 18th to San Diego, and Courtney Upshaw of Alabama, defensive end / linebacker, who I have going 24th there to the Squealers. So your thoughts on those guys and why you think they may get squeezed out of the first round potentially.
Well, starting with Mercilus, you know, I'm always concerned with coming out of nowhere. And I don't think it's fair to say he's a one-year wonder. However, the exact stat, but something like he went from 18 tackles in 2010 to 18 sacks in 2011. So I'm hesitant to just jump on board automatically. And then at the end of the day, when you look at a guy like that, we all kind of want to believe if the guy is over 6'2" and he's over 250 pounds, he has the ability to automatically be a 3-4 hybrid or play 4-3 with his hand in the dirt. I personally think that he's better with his hand in the dirt. I don't know that he necessarily equates ideally to a 3-4 system. And I think if he was going to go in the first round, he's probably going to someone like Pittsburgh, Houston, New England, Baltimore. And these are all 3-4 teams, or at least teams that employ the 3-4 at times. So I think he's a phenomenal talent. I just think once you get into the 20s, which is where I think he would have gone, I think there's just other things out there that teams are wanting to see. And this would be a great opportunity to mention something. I've done 4 or 5 versions of a mock draft, tweaking here and there. And as of today, this moment, I am so absolutely frustrated because you think you have a wrap on what teams are talking, what scouts are hearing, and then cross-referencing that with your own opinions. It's just normally we get to the point and everything's kind of settled in, and it seems like this year everyone's looking at it, and once you get to 20, everyone's all over the place all of a sudden. Clear out of the blue, we're completely changing everything. So if we had had the decision 5 days ago, I probably would have had Merciless going to Baltimore or even New England, but now I have no idea where their head's at with this kid because I keep hearing things that teams are uneasy about where you can play him and if he's scheme specific.
Well, that is always a concern when you're having to project guys. There are some players in the first round here that are a little bit unusual as far as being rated a little bit more strongly than you would normally consider somebody at their position. And the ones that really come to mind, somebody who has an excellent chance of being selected in the first half of the draft, which is unusual for a guard, David DeCastro of Stanford. You have safety Mark Barron of Alabama, who people look at as being a guy who can really kind of anchor the secondary and provide some support all around from that position. And good old Cousin Luke from Boston College here, an inside linebacker, a guy who really has all kinds of upside at that position. Somebody who I think you've compared in some ways to Patrick Willis, to Ray Lewis, et cetera. So these are guys that, again, you might not normally see them going as high as they're going to go, but that, I think, speaks to their specific value in this year's draft and the skill sets that they all have.
Yeah, real quick, some thoughts here. DeCastro is a beast. I personally do not like interior offensive linemen going in the first round. I know there are NFL people that will say, you know, if the guy's good, he's good. I say that's fine, but get him later. But DeCastro is a monster. Mark Barron has gone from absolute first rounder, but probably in the latter quarter, to as high as top 10. Everyone that I've talked to and from what I can see, he looks every bit the Ed Reed, Polamalu type as far as impact on the game. He looks like he could be that good. Luke Kuechly, that dude is a beast. Sean Lee is what he's probably closest to. He doesn't have the physical prowess of a Ray Lewis or Patrick Willis. But that guy is every inch the middle linebacker you want on your team.
And that's very important, yeah, because when you have a guy like that who can really anchor your defense, as I understand it, a lot of times the interior linebackers are responsible for some of the defensive play calling and everything. So, yeah, a guy with his all-around skill set would be very valuable. And taking kind of a broader look at the draft here, because, again, that's what these rankings that you have by position lend themselves to, as well as the top 50 overall. And then you've got your top 60 overall players. We've got some nice scouting notes for each one of the top 60 players here. So as we start to go through, again, what were some of your thoughts? So we've talked about it just briefly thus far, the overall depth of the draft class this year at many of the positions. And as I said, we graded out 10 of the 14 as being good or better in terms of overall depth and quality. So as you were going through this thing here, what were some of your, I'd say, most intriguing thoughts about what happens beyond the first round in this draft?
Well, if we just go in order, I think once you get past the top two picks, which will be quarterbacks, it starts to get a little dicey, and I really think that the guys coming off the board after that don't look as good until you get down the board a little bit. I've already mentioned, I think Tannehill is a cancer of a player in the first round. Whedon's nice, but, you know, you aren't going to get 10 years out of him, and I think that's a big problem. Cousins, Foles are all solid. Case Keenum had a phenomenal college career, but does it equate? Which brings me to my favorite prospect, and I'm kind of in the minority on this one, Brock Osweiler from Arizona State, and I think you can get him at the end of the second round at the very earliest. If you need a quarterback or you're looking for a guy to eventually take over, you do not have to get that guy in the first round, which is always a good thing. Running back has probably my favorite player in the entire draft, and especially for teams like, you know, Denver, who's got somebody there, but maybe not a long-term solution. Cincinnati is another one that could be looking at running back at some point. There's a guy by the name of Robert Turbin from Utah State.
Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely not joking about this. He is massive, and he's fast. He's a one-cut downhill runner. He's punishing. He runs through people, over people, around them, and has the ability to catch the football like a wide receiver. Literally, they throw 40-yard passes to this guy out of the backfield. But he's my favorite, and I think he's third round at the earliest. We talked about wide receiver. Tight end, you can almost punt it. I think it's safe to assume that Indianapolis might try to go get Fleener out of Stanford just to pair up his buddy. Tackle really, I think, falls out. I mean, tackle is really not a good position this year once you get past the, say, third guy on the board. Moving into defensive tackle, this is probably the deepest defensive tackle draft I can remember in recent years. And it all depends on what you want, really. I mean, 4-3 prototype, do you want a nose? Do you want a guy that can play a little bit of both, play that 5-gap? So it really depends, but it's very deep. 4-3 outside linebacker is really lame. Inside linebacker, rough, unless you, as we talked about earlier, before this call, unless you're going to take a chance on somebody like Perfect or somebody like him, I don't think your team should be considering a middle linebacker until probably the third round or even fourth. Defensive end is interesting because, you know, 3 years ago, Quentin Coples was without question the number one defensive end and or outside linebacker prospect, and now there's a possibility he could fall into the 20s. The cool thing about defensive end slash outside linebacker is the guys most people aren't considering, haven't heard of, or didn't see much that are probably going to translate to really good pros. A couple names there that will jump out, Vinnie Curry from Marshall, Shea McClellan from Boise State, who a lot of people are saying is a bigger, more impactful Vrabel-type player. And then you get into the secondary, and here's where I'm going to differ from most people. I think Mark Barron is an automatic stud. I think Harrison Smith deserves to go in the first round, even though he'll probably fall to the second. Tremaine Johnson out of Montana is a very intriguing prospect. He can play both corner and safety. And here's for your big headline. Morris Claiborne may be one of the more overrated players in the draft. Morris Claiborne is good. He's a starting cornerback in the NFL. However, I think if you're going to pick him in the top 10, he better be a shutdown Champ Bailey type, and I do not think that's the case. I like Dre Kirkpatrick and Stephen Gilmore, but my favorite corner, and you really got to sit back and say, how do I feel about the conduct policy, is Janoris Jenkins. If Janoris Jenkins conducted himself like Tim Tebow, he'd go in the top 3 picks, regardless of quarterback situation. Janoris Jenkins is by far the most gifted quarterback in this draft, but because he can't keep his head on straight, he'll probably fall to the second.
Well, that's always the deal with a lot of these guys. You've got his issues. You've got Mike Adams, offensive tackle from Ohio State, who showed up at the draft with a little bit of the Chiba still in his system. You got, as you indicated, Vontaze Burfict. You had told me off air about showing up to the draft, okay, what do you jerks want from me? So yeah, there's always problems. There's always landmines that lay ahead there. And Morris Claiborne with the 4 on the Wonderlic that leaked out, and that's obviously not going to help his case any. And sort of there's all kinds of different things that happen there. And you actually, and we actually have some notes from you in there about the combine in Pro Football Draftology 2012 and your thoughts on this. There's a lot of people that really want to put down the process and, oh, it's all overthinking. It's all just a bunch of gaga. But as you pointed out, there is a scientific reason for why everybody goes through this process. And it is possible to overinterpret certain aspects of it, certainly. But people really, really throw out the baby with the bathwater when they start putting down the combine as a whole.
Yeah, this huge pet peeve of mine when people, especially fans, just kind of go, combine, it's not important, it's just a whole bunch of guys in shorts and you can't learn anything from that. Well, that's not true. The most important thing you learn from the combine is when your players get sit in that little egg device, which is, from my understanding, the most conclusive medical test they can go through, so you can find out what's happened to the player physically and how good he's doing in that regard. But more importantly than that, the combine is a piece of the equation. I don't believe it should be weighted more so than game tape. As a matter of fact, I believe just the opposite of that. However, you can't go just on game tape, otherwise you have situations. Players coming out being drafted very high, and then 3 years later, fans going, what the hell? This guy looks so good in college, and now he's a bust. Well, that's because he found out later that he runs, a 4.8 40 and can't get separation. The combine's important, but it's just one part of the equation. And to completely discredit it is ridiculous. Now, an interesting little tidbit that we're going to deal with in the first round at some point is Mr. Don Terry Poe from Memphis, who during the combine was an absolute monster. Problem is, after the combine, these scouts and GMs and player personnel people go back and look at tape again, and now we're starting to see that, well, maybe Don Terry Poe is just a combine freak, because clearly he took plays off. Doesn't have the greatest motor. He seems to have motivational issues. But, if we had to draft him, Don Terry Poe is a top 10 pick. Right now it's looking like he could fall into the 20s, and that's what's supposed to happen. You're supposed to look at a 340-pound defensive tackle who runs, a sub-5.40 and can bench press like nobody's business and go back and reevaluate the tape. It's all part of the process, but anybody that wants to discredit the combine as if it doesn't matter is just completely off their rocker.
Very well said, because that's what we've always believed at FDH, that these things have to be part of a holistic process. You look at all different elements of something to make an intelligent decision. Obviously, game tape is not to be disregarded. It's a very strong part of this. It's a very strong part of what you're doing here in this. Again, the measurables that we get from the combine and all of these things really kind of taken together, what the coaches have to say. A lot of times it's off the record. But again, this chatter has really hurt, as you and I were talking about off air the other night, Vontaze Burfict for all the deficiencies that have shown up with him. What's also interesting is in terms of his Sun Devil teammate, Brock Osweiler, I mentioned previously that we'll be joined for our post-draft wrap-up by FDH Lounge dignitary Chris Galloway. And I should mention that's another point of strong agreement between the two of you guys, because when I was talking to him off air and talking up your thoughts on Brock Osweiler, he agreed completely. So when you're talking about guys who can be found later on in the draft who can really give you that kind of value, he certainly would be one of those guys.
Absolutely. Brock Osweiler, let's be honest, he's not going to step in and start for anybody right away. But that's the point here is, in this league, unless you've got that, you know, top 10 pick to get that year's stud blue chip quarterback prospect, he's probably not going to step right in right away. And I think Andy Dalton's probably the most recent exception to that rule. But a guy like Osweiler, he's almost 6'8". He can see over all offensive linemen, and he's got a cannon, an absolute cannon, and he's got a decent amount of touch. He just needs to, you know, be taught the new speed of the game, some of the nuances, and he's the kind of guy that you could look to eventually take over. And we talked about Cleveland earlier, and I'll bring this up as an example. If for whatever reason Cleveland is able to do what I want them to do, and that is get either Richardson and the next best wide receiver possible in the first round, and I would love for them to come back at the top of the second round and get Janoris Jenkins to go next to Joe Hayden. If they could do something like that, then by all means, in the third round, if you want to, pull the trigger on a guy like Osweiler or even a Kirk Cousins. But these are guys that you draft, and you let them compete with your incumbent starting quarterback, and you see how things happen. But as far as quarterbacks that you think can step in right away, I think you're limited to about three guys, and Ryan Tannehill is not on that list.
No, he's not. He's not. Notwithstanding a lot of the things that are being said on his behalf right now, and again, as we've talked about on the show previously, and that we even put up one of our best of segments recently of me being chastised by WFAN in New York's Joe Benigno for being a fan of the Dolphins as well as the Browns. Benigno being a guy who feels that you can't have two teams that you root for, albeit the Dolphins are my secondary team. I feel great pain at the notion of them going for Ryan Tannehill at 8. And I think you'd even said in an email, hey, sorry about your Dolphins, but I think it's going that way. And yeah, it's one of those things where, again, just reaching for need. We've got a little bit of a commentary in the draft guide that I had actually put in here. And it was, again, prompted by some of this Ryan Tannehill talk, and he should go in the top 10 and everything like that. Well, that stems from, really, well, Luck's gone and Griffin's gone, and there's still bad teams that need a quarterback. So take Ryan Tannehill because he's the next best guy. And that's something that we talk about so much, Jason, in terms of fantasy sports. And it's really one of the biggest keys to our coverage here. The nexus between fantasy sports, which is our core with fantasydrafthealth.com, and pro sports. It all stems from the same philosophy of value. Never, ever, ever get caught at the back end of a run. And that's what's going to happen if a team takes Ryan Tannehill in the top 10, reaching for need.
Absolutely, and you know, just because Ryan Tannehill is, you know, 6'5", 220 pounds, and can throw the ball a mile doesn't mean a single thing, because that's exactly what everyone said about Jamarcus Russell. The guy has terrible, terrible decision-making record. He has never won a single game that was close that mattered when his team was within shot to do so. He's not a leader. He's only been a quarterback for a couple of years, and it shows up on the tape. It's just not a good idea. Now, we've talked off air before, and I said, I like Brandon Whedon, but I don't think he's as good as taking him in the, you know, say the second half of the first round. And there's a couple other guys in that mix, but just because the guy is third on your board doesn't mean he needs to go anywhere near the first two. And if somebody actually does believe in Ryan Tannehill, that's fine. But take him after the 20s. Trade back. If you're Miami and Tannehill's your guy, trade back. There's got to be somebody up there that wants Melvin Ingram or Mark Barron or something has to materialize to allow you to trade back, because it would be ridiculous to take Tannehill that high. Now, as I mentioned before, everything's getting jumbled now in the last few days here. I actually am of the thought that, you know, maybe not a majority thought, but there's the inkling that Miami may be holding serve here and specifically not going to take Ryan Tannehill again, like I just mentioned, in the hopes that somebody wants to jump up to 8 to get somebody else, and they can fall back, and maybe they can go and snake a Brandon Wheaton maybe in the teens or something. But no one should hold their breath on the idea that they know where Tannehill's going to go, because he's one of those guys that's completely in flux at the moment.
Yeah, there are a couple of wild cards, and we see a couple of guys like that every year, and he certainly is in there as the number three quarterback, at least in terms of consensus, and the guy who was underneath the top tier when the teams just say, got to have him, and end up going for him, regardless of whether or not he would fit that value in any kind of conventional sense. So, all right, to bring this full circle, Jason, you know, we've talked about this, that a deep draft, again, we've regarded 10 of the 14 positions as being good or better in terms of overall quality. Obviously, the storylines being Luck and Griffin going 1-2 at the top of the draft here to Indy and to Washington. The depth in terms of wide receivers. One of the things that I've seen in some of your notes have been a little bit of a weakness in terms of outside linebackers in this class. It's one of the exceptions to the rule. But what are any of the other notes that we haven't covered in your mind? What any of the remaining elements that are going to help define the 2012 NFL draft?
Well, the big one is really pass rush. If you're a fan of a team and that you think needs a pass rush, do not be worried if they don't take them in the first round. Because there's two guys out there, depending on scheme, that I think are just absolutely phenomenal. One we mentioned before, and that's Vinnie Curry from Marshall. The only way he goes in the first round, I think, is if Belichick just gets ballsy. But he is every bit the 4-3 defensive end and or 3-4 outside linebacker. He is physically a freak. If you're running a 4-3 scheme, though, and need a traditional just outside linebacker, there is another defensive end that translates to the 4-3 outside linebacker, and that would be Bruce Irvin from West Virginia. He's only 6'3", 245, but as an outside linebacker, he runs 4-4 speed. He may not be a three-down guy, but if you need a pass rush, he's incredible and would probably be available in the middle rounds. The other thing is, this is one of those years where I say, if the value is bad, punt the position. If you think you need an inside linebacker and you can't get one of the top two guys, and those would be Kuechly and Hightower, then don't sweat it. Worry about it next year. Or try to pick somebody up in free agency with what's left. It's just not a good idea because the positions that are thin are really thin. But, yeah, I would say pass rush is going to be a big one. Defensive line is going to be a big one. Offensive line is not. I don't think there's even 15 guys when you combine all three positions that I think are even starter worthy at the offensive line. And then the skill position, wide receiver running backs, really going to be impressive because it goes pretty deep. And they don't all have to be big-time, big program type guys to be impressive, because there's some guys that no one's heard, none of these people watching the draft are going to say they've heard of before. But they have the potential to really do some damage. And it's going to be fun, right? It's one of those drafts where I think if you really get into the NFL and you get into your team, you'll be able to look back at this and say, going into the third round, that there's still X number of guys that you've got your eye on.
Yeah, and it's going to be a tremendous thing, and looking forward to our continuing coverage of it. As I indicated, we'll have post-draft coverage probably coming next weekend. We'll be setting that up in the days to come here, and you and I will be joined, of course, by FDH Lounge dignitary Chris Galloway for that. Because of our format over the last year of moving to the mini episodes and self-distribution here, this is the first time that we've been able to do this. We will have a link for this because this show and our draft guide are going up pretty much simultaneously here, Pro Football Draftology 2012. We will have a link right there on the front page of Pro Football Draftology 2012 to this pre-draft show. So if anybody wants to go back and double check anything that we said, or did they really say that, or what were some of their thoughts about what happened here, you can go back and you can check it out. Link right there on the cover at the FDH Lounge Multimedia Magazine, where you can find all of our programming, the FDHLounge.blogspot.com. Jason, always a pleasure, my friend. Great work on all of this. Thank you, as always, for keying up our coverage and making us, I think, the place to go for the NFL draft stuff. That's all on you, and we really appreciate it.
Well, it's always fun. It's in some regards, it's almost like my Super Bowl.